Collins. Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Tuesday, October 8th, 2019. Happy birthday to my brother Dan. And as we begin the podcast, I have to alert you that tomorrow is iffy for 29 counties in California. There are extreme wildfire warnings. The red flags haven't been flown yet, but our rogue and bankrupt utility, Pacific Gas and Electric, is warning that 29 of California's 58 counties, that's half the state, will face a preemptive power outage starting tonight and possibly continuing tomorrow and into Thursday. Because of tinder dry conditions, unusual northerly winds that will be gusting up to 60 miles an hour, the utility, which has been burned, sorry for that intentional pun, but by wildfire damage and the liability claims that forced it to seek coverage in bankruptcy, they're now taking a very extreme preemptive approach. And so if you are looking for somebody in California tomorrow in the northern half of the state, there's a good chance that they won't be able to communicate unless they remember to charge their phones. Also, I want to mention that yesterday you may have gotten two podcasts. You may have gotten one. We're trying to straighten out the glitches that prevented me from posting on Friday. The Friday podcast was stuck in the pipeline, and we posted it early in the afternoon Pacific time yesterday. Then I delivered a fresh podcast for Monday, but it came through an alternative path that may not have reached many listeners. So I am going to correct that today. I believe I have the right routing. And we shall see. Please give me a report if you do receive this podcast through your normal download process. Everybody's a little different. Let me know if the new approach has produced any ripple effects. I know that the RSS feed wasn't working yesterday. I think we're going to be able to correct that. So it's a day-by-day effort, and I hope that we get it all under control very soon here. So there's a new poll out. Washington Post paid for it, and it's a pretty decent sample size, and it shows growing support for impeachment. The broad number is 58% to 38% Americans say the House was correct to open the impeachment inquiry. More than 8 in 10 Democrats endorse it. Nearly 8 in 10 favor a vote to recommend that Trump be removed from office. Among Republicans, it's almost the flip. 7 in 10 don't support the inquiry, but 3 in 10 do. And one-fifth of Republicans, or almost, say they favor a vote recommending his removal. Among independent voters, support for the impeachment effort has risen to 57%, and almost half, 49%, say that the House should vote to remove Trump from office. So this is a significant shift since July. The increase for Democrats, 25 points, Republicans, 21 points, and among independents, 20 points. Now, that doesn't mean diddly. If the White House continues to stonewall and the Democrats are left having to seek relief in the courts, which could take for effing ever. So today, Gordon Sondland, who most of us had never heard of until last week when Kurt Volker released text messages that he sent to and received with Sondland. He is the ambassador to the European Union, paid about $1 million to various Trump entities, campaign and the inauguration, to buy that job. And Sondland said he wanted to appear. He wants to do all that explaining, how there was no quid pro quo. But the White House is digging in. They claim that the House Democrats are running a kangaroo court, and so they will continue to obstruct that. Now, I can understand that, defensively speaking, it's probably to Trump's advantage to call it a kangaroo court and to drag this out using stonewall tactics and legal maneuvers and just outright defiance as long as possible. And as expected, Adam Schiff sees this as another episode of attempted obstruction, which could become an article of impeachment by itself down the line. So over on the other side of Capitol Hill, Lindsey Graham, who's really pissed at Trump about the latest announced effort to withdraw from Syria, he has invited Rudy Giuliani to appear before the Senate Judiciary Committee to get Rudy's side of the story about Ukraine and about Trump's claims that Ukraine was the real meddler in the 2016 election. We're going to address that in a few minutes here. There is substantial evidence behind that, and I know that troubles a lot of Democrats. We also will wait to see this Friday whether the former ambassador, Marie Yovanovitch, will be permitted to testify. It's an interview with the committees, so it's not like a public testimony. And it remains to be seen, because Sondland still works for the Trump administration. The order for him not to appear at least has some basis. But Yovanovitch, who was recalled from Ukraine, it's not clear to me if she's still an employee of the State Department and therefore could be ordered to refuse to appear. On impeachment, if you only read one thing today, would you please follow the link in today's podcast show file over to Tom Dispatch and read this great essay by Andrew Basevich. Now, as you know, I admire the former colonel, also a professor of history at Boston University, for his informed take on American foreign policy. And he addresses impeachment. He runs through four possible scenarios. Trump might resign. The Republicans might come to their senses and give the Democrats the two-third majority needed in the Senate to remove him. He also speculates, and this is pretty far-fetched, that people like Mitch McConnell and other senators who are up for re-election in 2020 or even 2022, will decide that turning on Trump might save their own skins. But he concludes the most likely outcome is the House will impeach and the Senate will not convict or remove him. But he really gets going, and you got to read this part where he says, look, the unspoken purpose of impeachment is not removal, but restoration. The aim is not to replace Trump with Mike Pence, the equivalent of exchanging Groucho for Harpo, that's a good line. No, the object of the exercise is to return power to those who created the conditions that enabled Trump to win the White House in the first place. He notes that Hillary Clinton recently declared Trump to be an illegitimate president. He says, here we glimpse the true meaning of legitimacy in this context. Whatever the vote in the Electoral College, Trump doesn't deserve to be president and never did. For many of the main participants in this melodrama, the actual but unstated purpose of impeachment is to correct the great wrong and thereby restore history to its anointed path. He says these centrists share a common worldview, and listen to this litany. They believe in the universality of freedom as defined and practiced within the U.S. They believe in corporate capitalism operating on a planetary scale, in American primacy, with the U.S. presiding over a global order as the sole superpower. They believe in American global leadership, which they define as primarily a military enterprise. And perhaps most of all, they came to believe in a so-called meritocracy as the preferred mechanism for allocating wealth, power, and privilege. All of these together comprise the sacred scripture of contemporary American political elites. And if Trump's antagonists have their way, his removal will restore that sacred scripture to its proper place as the basis of policy. So take a look. I think he makes some very provocative comments. And while I do believe that Trump is impeachable, he's committed crimes, the clear crime of the Michael Cohen plea deal and the hush money to Stormy Daniels and the Playboy Playmate, that's not what the Democrats are focusing on. And as I've said since this whole Ukraine thing surfaced, I think that they are taking the wrong route to impeachment. So today in the corporate media, we get the Washington Post recycling bullshit from Russiagate. Under the headline, bipartisan Senate report calls for sweeping effort to prevent Russian interference in 2020 election. And part two of the Intelligence Committee's report has been published. And according to the Post, The second volume offered the most detailed and robust set of recommendations so far in attempting to bolster the nation's defenses. Only the Washington Post didn't even tease us with a single one of those robust recommendations. Instead, they recycle the claims that preceded Mueller and that were rubber-stamped by Mueller. They recycle the garbage claims about, you know, Russian interference on Facebook, manipulating and brainwashing Americans. They recite the discredited number of 126 million people reached by the Russian campaign on Facebook. But they don't mention the recommendations. And there's one simple one. You've heard it here before. Hand-counted paper ballots. All of this claim about Russian, brainwashing and messaging and influence operations, it doesn't compare to what Americans do to ourselves. And yet, this is the deus ex machina, that murky outside godlike force that has intervened, and we're just victims of it. It's so bogus. All right, now to the New York Times recycling Russophobia. Headline, top secret Russian unit seeks to destabilize Europe, security officials say. Now, they quote one guy, Peter Zwack, a retired military intelligence officer who served at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. And he speaks for all Western security officials who have now concluded that Russian operations in Moldova, in Bulgaria, in Montenegro, and more recently in Salisbury, England, the Skripal case, form a pattern of Russian efforts to destabilize Europe. Now, let me say that I don't doubt that Russia has an inclination to break up the European Union. They're not unhappy about Brexit and watching Britain go through this self-flagellation. And yes, there is a long-running feud between NATO and Russia. And Putin does, I'm sure, have schemes to address that. But this article is so hysterical, and it recycles Russiagate. Last year, Robert S. Mueller, the special counsel, blah, 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 indicted more than a dozen officers of the GRU, though all still remain at large, because it was a show investigation by Mueller. The indictments were just for theater. We're never going to see those people prosecuted. And the flimsy evidence that was recycled from the intelligence community and referenced in the Mueller report without any public evidence of the so-called Russian hacking, it's insulting. That's what it is. So the article says that there is a unit called 29155, and it tries to tie the individuals who were identified in Salisbury and linked to the release of Novichok, which I'm still highly skeptical of, it ties them to some of these other operations. And, as I say, it may be true, but the hysterical coverage is simply yellow journalism, in my opinion. The other big piece I want to recommend to you, you can watch the video or read the transcript of Max Blumenthal's appearance on Aaron Maté's new video show called Pushback. And let me quote from Max Blumenthal. He goes through the predictable anti-Trump statements to prove that he's not a MAGA guy. And then he says this: Ukraine absolutely did interfere in the 2016 election. Its interference was possibly more consequential than anything Russia allegedly did. And they cite that Serhiy Lyushenko released, he was a legislator in Ukraine. He released the black ledger that exposed Paul Manafort and the cash payments in the millions that he got from Viktor Yanukovych and the Party of Regions. And Blumenthal is correct, because that revelation came after the work of a woman who was on the Hillary Clinton campaign. Her name is Alexandra Chalupa, who has Ukrainian heritage. She was consulting for the DNC met with top officials in the Ukrainian embassy in Washington, and successfully exposed the black ledger that led to Paul Manafort's conviction. Was this the beginning of the effort that then flipped into projection mode as the Democrats tried to deflect from their support from Ukraine by claiming that Trump got support from Russia? So it's a very interesting and well-argued case made by Max Blumenthal. Let me quote one more item here. In the case of Russiagate, by talking about the stolen Democratic emails that brought attention to the fact that those emails revealed corruption by Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party against Bernie Sanders. Now again, the victim, purported victim here, is Joe Biden. So now Democrats are in the awkward position where they have to defend the fact that Joe Biden's son Hunter got $50,000 a month on a Ukrainian gas company's board of directors months after his father helped back the coup. And by the way, that's a quote from Aaron Maté. I don't want to confuse you. That's not from Max himself. So they go into more detail about the Burisma case. And while Blumenthal notes that he can't prove one way or the other whether Viktor Shokin was really conducting an investigation of Burisma, he said there is plenty of dirt there for everyone to be concerned about. The New York Times is catching up because yesterday they were scooped by the Associated Press, reporting that Energy Secretary Rick Perry has been working with his oil patch pals from Texas and Trump donors to try to force the government of Ukraine to put some friendly people on the board of a gas company there. And the New York Times parallels the coverage today without really adding too much new to it. And it is a serious embarrassment as Trump talks about corruption, the corruption of Joe and Hunter Biden, and then, you know, has to ignore or just deflect from the profiteering moves made by his cabinet officials and his good friend Rudy Giuliani. Now, here's another embarrassing issue for Democrats in pursuing Ukraine as the basis for impeachment. And last week I shared with you that I know the Pelosi family a little bit. I did some campaign work for Nancy Pelosi over 20 years ago, and I know her son, Paul Jr. And I mentioned that Paul Jr. went with the speaker. She may have just been the minority leader at the time, but on a junket to China, and that he came back with some business contacts. Well, you can't find this in the corporate media. You got to go to flaky right-wing outlets. But it's very clear, the evidence is there, that Paul Pelosi Jr. went to Ukraine in 2017, and he came back with a board seat on a company called Viscoil, and it has a related subsidiary called NRG Lab. And Nancy Pelosi even appeared in a promotional video for the company, which you can find at YouTube. So he went there, Paul Jr. did, in July of 17. As the executive director of the Corporate Governance Initiative. While he was there, he said he was there to discuss a youth soccer partnership. I don't know where that comes from. And on March 5th of 2013, NRG Lab New Technology posted two videos on YouTube. One opened with a clip of Nancy discussing energy-efficient technology, followed by a direct-to-camera statement from Paul Jr., "My name's Paul Pelosi. I'm on the board of Viscoil." Now, let me correct one misstatement I may have made. He did make a trip there in 2017, but his connection goes back to 2013. So, how did he get that gig? And by the way, Viscoil Holdings had a registration with the California Secretary of State, which is currently suspended. And if you do a search for Paul Pelosi Jr., and Ukraine, this popped up, a company that he founded with the former Governor Tony Anaya of New Mexico, Natural Blue Resources, was charged by the Securities and Exchange Commission with fraud And this goes back, the company was founded in 2019. The fraud charges were surfacing in 2014. So Paul Pelosi Jr., like Hunter Biden, has benefited from his family name and power introductions, at a minimum. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. And let's see who's on the hot list today. Susan Gavet, Carl Howard, Nancy Kilgore just renewed her annual subscription. Thank you, Nancy. And Jim Garrison kicks in $20 a month. He's very generous. I appreciate their support. I need others to help out, so why don't you step up and take out a new subscription today? Just visit peterbcollins.com. You click on Menu, then click on Become a Subscriber, and then you hit the sign-up page, and it's easy to make those choices. Also, I want to put out the word that one of the technical issues I've been having is compounded by the fact that my webmaster, John Gorenfeld, who's supported me for many years, moved to England a couple of years ago, and he's got a young baby, and it's very hard for him to respond when I have an emergency here in California. So he has suggested that I find a new webmaster. And I just want to put the word out there, if you're a listener to this podcast and you have the skills with HTML, with WordPress, you've done the integration with audio files and podcast platforms, I would love to hear from you. And by the way, you would not be volunteering, okay? Just drop an email to Peter at peterbcollins.com. So there's a lot of wailing in Washington, D.C., because on Sunday night, without consulting anybody in his team, Trump announced that he's pulling troops out of Syria. And early Monday morning, American troops were on the move. Now, there are some people who think that this is going to be walked back like the last attempt last fall was. But the bipartisan howling over this is so embarrassing to me. Because, yes, there are issues. There are some 11,000 Islamic State prisoners, 2,000 are from other countries, 9,000 are from the region. We don't know what the Kurds will do now that they know that they have officially been abandoned by the United States again. And Turkey may slaughter the Kurds, who were loyal mercenaries for the United States in this off-the-books proxy war in Syria over the last 5 years. And here's Charlie Savage talking about those prisons. He writes, that's at the New York Times, by the way. The Kurds are menaced from the north by Turkey, which has been fighting separatist Kurds inside its borders for years and considers the Syrian Kurds to be terrorists. Meanwhile, President Assad of Syria, backed by Russia, controls the southern part of the country and wants to eventually retake it all, raising the possibility of a deal with the Kurds. Now, we've seen these kind of tribal units can just overnight reflag and switch to another side. Especially in Afghanistan, that has occurred quite a bit. And it remains to be seen how this plays out. But I still say Trump is on the right path. He does things in a bad way. I don't approve of just these instant and emotional decisions that he makes. And chances are he had a bad phone call with Erdogan on Sunday and just got pissed off and gave the order. So it's another phone call we need to see the transcript of. And here's David Sanger, the lead apologist for neocons at the New York Times. Trump is once again pursuing a national security strategy at odds with the official position of his government. It is a move that his own senior advisors have warned would risk new chaos throughout the region. The mission has been to prevent the Islamic State forces from reconstituting and to keep another conflict at bay, a Turkish attack on Kurdish forces. And Trump's decision is played as childlike, emotional. But he has been consistent. He doesn't want to continue. He doesn't call them regime change wars, but our foreign misadventures. And this is a point where Democrats should recognize that Obama was wrong to put U.S. troops into Syria in the first place. Here's another column from the New York Times under the byline of Carlotta Gall. She writes, amid the criticism over Trump's Syria policy, one former American ally has welcomed the decision. The Rebel Free Syrian Army, now called the National Army. I didn't know that. And, you know, this is where we see the neocons, together with the corporate media, support an endless war. And at most, we have 1,000 American troops in the giant country of Syria. We have no impact there. We claim that, oh, yeah, that this is what, you know, I heard Leon Panetta on TV last night, former defense secretary and CIA director, a guy I knew when he was a member of Congress way back when. And he's just saying all the same old stuff. You can't leave. U.S. forces are integral to maintaining the status quo there. And what the hell is the status quo? I want to recommend Danny Sersin's piece at andywar.com. He says, Trump appears poised finally to end the U.S. military mission in Syria. This would constitute the first actual follow-through on the promises of candidate Trump to avoid stupid and terminate endless Mideast wars. And that's no small thing. Now, he says this is likely to be messy, if not tragic. And that he has long argued for an end to America's ill-advised, all-risk, no-reward quagmire in Syria. He goes on to say, the way the mission appears to be ending promises great, if ultimately unavoidable, human suffering, especially for the Kurds. Trump has sold out his Kurdish partners, the main ground force that defeated the territorial Islamic State. It's not just that the U.S. military is leaving, but Washington has veritably green-lighted an impending Turkish army and Air Force invasion of northeast Syria. And Sersin says, personally, I think it is just as well that the U.S. military get out of a risky morass in yet another fractured Mideast country. That said, this latest in a long line of American betrayals demonstrates the broader tragedy of U.S. imperialism and hyper-interventionalism. And over at The Intercept, a good piece, Historical References, by John Schwartz, who identifies the 8 different times, this is the 8th, that the United States has betrayed the Kurds. Today at whowhatwhy.org, I've got a fresh podcast there interviewing Tracy Rosenberg about a story I reported on a week ago Monday, that under the Homeland Security and Joint Terrorism Task Forces, the uber-liberal city of Berkeley, California, borrowed some high-tech surveillance cameras, and then they bought some of their own and installed them in a park, despite the fact that it conflicts with their own laws. Here's an excerpt from my interview with Tracy Rosenberg.
In terms of Berkeley, the interesting thing was not only did they not tell anyone, but they actually had a law on the books, which we advocated for, a surveillance transparency ordinance that specifically required them to get city council consent before they took actions like this and have some kind of public hearing where they put out what they were planning to do, and the city council affirmatively said, yes, we will let this happen in Berkeley. Never happened.
That's Tracy Rosenberg, a co-founder of Oakland Privacy. There's a lot to the interview. We talk about mission creep. You know, we were told that the fusion centers and the terrorism task forces, this is all to protect us from international terrorism. And now it's being focused on domestic First Amendment activists. We've talked a lot recently about the skirmishes on the streets of Hong Kong and Baghdad. Now we need to look at Quito, Ecuador, where violent protests have been running for days now. And it's led the President Lenin Moreno to decamp from the capital. He's moving to a coastal city and waiting for the protests to die down. Now, this was predictable. He actually declared a state of emergency after he bowed to the International Monetary Fund and its austerity measures, and he killed a 40-year subsidy for gasoline that helped the poorest Ecuadorians survive. And this was part of the deal where he coughed up Julian Assange, then signed the IMF agreement, and here at the beginning of October, it's taking effect. 570 people have been arrested from the protests so far. And for great background on the situation in Ecuador, I recommend a piece by the Gray Zone's Dennis Rogachuk. I've linked to it in the show file for today's podcast, and it gives you a lot of good background on how we got to where we are today. Now, I'm releasing a podcast of my own today at peterbcollins.com and all the usual outlets. I caught up with Paul Leto, and 10, 12 years ago, Paul Leto was an attorney working on election integrity issues in Washington State and elsewhere. More recently, he had moved to North Dakota, where he was working at a gas operations plant. And he discovered serious safety issues and a spill of effluent. It's not all completely oil. It is called natural gas condensate. And the plant where he worked sits on a reported 11 million gallons of this ugly soup, which includes benzene and other carcinogenic chemicals. Here's an excerpt from that interview with Paul Leto.
Right, and I was there when this spill was discovered. And, you know, first of all, the $11 million, it's 11 million gallons, it's very important to recognize that comes from a document from the contractor who's doing the cleanup. And the document specifically says it's a one oak estimate of 11 million gallons. What it literally says is ORM estimate of 11 million gallons. That stands for One Oak Rockies Midstream. That's who paid me. That's the name on my paycheck. So This is a one oak estimate of the spill size, not anybody's, you know, made up number out of thin air or anything like that. And also, there is a first anonymous whistleblower. I'm not anonymous. Who came forward and said, I was present at the meeting in the state capital of Bismarck when One Oak updated the state, you know, on the 11 million gallon size of the spill. So you got a whistleblower and you got a document that's saying it's basically larger than the Exxon Valdez. But for years, you've got an official report that is linked at the DeSmog blog. It basically says it's 10 gallons. It says it's 10 gallons or less. And at one point it says there's an unknown additional volume in the soil.
I invite you to listen to the full interview with Paul Leto. It's available for my subscribers today, if everything is working, at peterbcollins.com, iTunes, TuneIn, Spreaker, and Stitcher. This is a big surprise. The Commerce Department of the Trump administration is pushing back on China's human rights violations in Xinjiang province. This is the persecution of the Muslim minority called the Uyghurs. And I'm shocked to report that the Department of Commerce has announced that 28 Chinese companies and government entities have been added to a blacklist for their roles in these human rights violations. These are the security companies that use the artificial intelligence that has created a blanket, a dragnet, over the province and the prisons. They're called re-education camps by the Chinese government. But this is a shocking development. After all, I just told you that Trump had agreed with Xi Jinping that the U.S. will remain silent on the protests in Hong Kong. And speaking of that, you know that an official of the National Basketball Association is in hot water because he tweeted a comment in support of the protesters in Hong Kong. And the NBA is sending its top dog to China to try to smooth things over. But it shows how people who are more interested in getting revenue and profits out of China are willing to sacrifice fundamental rights of expression. And I want to commend the goons over at South Park, Trey Parker and Matt Stone, because they learned that China has now banned at least one episode of South Park. The ruling Communist Party has wiped out video clips and discussions of the show. Last week's episode was called Banned in China. And there were blog posts and discussion platforms where all of that has been purged. So, the funny guys at South Park issued this mock apology today. Like the NBA, we welcome the Chinese censors into our homes and into our hearts. We, too, love money more than freedom and democracy. And Z doesn't look like Winnie the Pooh at all. Oh, I should explain. That was part of this episode Banned in China. And that's B-A-N-D, not B-A-N-N-E-D. Banned in China had a scene where they compared the facial look of Xi Jinping to Winnie the Pooh. That's all I got today. You're free to share this far and wide. You'll find it on YouTube. And I am Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.